Good morning. Our scripture passage for this, the sermon this morning, comes from the book of Mark, continuing in the book of Mark. This morning we'll be looking through chapter 8, the first 26 verses of chapter 8. We come here in chapter 8 to the second of two feedings of bread to large crowds. And if you'll recall, we're following the account of Jesus interacting with the scribes and Pharisees from Jerusalem concerning purity rituals and rules, and then him healing the daughter of a Syrophoenician woman. And now we come in Mark chapter 8 to see Jesus having compassion on a crowd that has been following him. Hear with me now God's word to us. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they said. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up the 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present. And having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus, to test him. They said, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for 1 loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "It is because we have no bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" They answered, 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and had put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his hands were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, "Don't go into the village." So this morning we'll start off with a question, or I want to posit a question to you. When I say the word sign, what do you think of? What does that word, the word sign, what does it mean to you? Suppose you were driving down the road and you approached a red sign that had the letters S-T-O-P on it. If this were the case, you would come to a stop, more than likely. Well, you should. And if I asked the question why, you would say, "Well, because there's a sign there and I know what that sign means. It means that I'm supposed to come to a stop before proceeding." Now, suppose you were driving in another country and there was a sign. And you had no clue what the sign was for, but really the sign that you saw was telling you to stop. So you ignore it. You blow right through the sign because you didn't know what it meant. And lo and behold, a police officer pulls behind you, turns on his lights. "Ah, this is easy," you think to yourself. "All I have to tell him is, 'Officer, I didn't know what that sign meant.'" "Well, that's nice," he says, "but you should have read the driver's handbook." And then he proceeds to issue you a ticket. Well, are you at fault? Yes, I think we all would acknowledge, yes, you're at fault. Why? Because signs carry meanings. But let me propose another situation. You're in high school, and you go to the house of a friend, and as you walk inside of his room, you notice a large red sign there that has the letters STOP on it. Well, what do you do? Do you stop moving until he says it's all right? Do you come to a complete stop until you're ready to proceed? Of course not, you say. But wait a minute. Didn't we just say a moment ago that signs carry meaning? And something you may notice with this small example is that the meaning of signs is much more complex than simply an A equals B formula or red sign means stop whenever, wherever. Instead, signs are placed within a string of connections, a complex string of connections. In reading, we call this a context. Signs are placed within a context, and the meaning of the sign is in part derived from that context. By now, you may be asking yourself, what in the world does getting a ticket for blowing through a stop sign in a foreign country have anything to do with Mark chapter 8? Well, good question. You see, I wanted to get you to start thinking about signs and why they are there and what they are. Because Mark, for the past few chapters, has been playing with a sign for quite a while. The sign of bread. And here in chapter 8, it's all going to come together and make sense. We come to this section as the final act of a scene that has been playing out thus far. It started all the way back in chapter 6, verse 30. Do you remember what happened there? Jesus and the apostles came to the shore, and they saw a great crowd. And Jesus said they were as sheep without a shepherd. And then Jesus responded by giving bread to the people, and the disciples also received bread. But the disciples, while on the boat, didn't understand the significance of this act. Why? Well, we're told by Mark that it was because their hearts were hardened. In response to this, Jesus healed the sick in the whole region of Gennesaret. And then we see Jesus getting us on the shore and going out and meeting the scribes and the Pharisees from Jerusalem. And as soon as they meet, the Pharisees and the scribes from Jerusalem come and they challenge him. They challenge him about breaking purity rules. And do you remember what the challenge was? The scribes and the Pharisees came and said literally to Jesus, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating their bread with unwashed hands. But what didn't the scribes and Pharisees understand? It was that their traditions of purity do not defile because they enter the stomach, not the heart. And it is out of the heart which comes evil intentions. Well, in response to this, Jesus goes to Tyre, meets a Gentile woman from the region of Syrophoenicia. She's called a Syrophoenician woman, and she asks for just crumbs of bread. And in response, Jesus feeds her, metaphorically, by healing her daughter. In other words, he didn't merely give her crumbs, he gave her bread. What I hope you have noticed through this brief survey of the past few chapters that make up this section in Mark's Gospel is that this section is one that is overly concerned with bread and the heart. Everyone is talking about passing around or eating bread, and yet the problem in every scene is that someone has a hard heart. And now we come to chapter 8, and we find Jesus once again being followed by a great crowd. And I want you to notice how Jesus responds to this great crowd. He says, I have great compassion on them because they have been with me for 3 days and now they have nothing to eat. If I send them home now, they will faint on the way. And at this point, what are you as a reader thinking? Your mind is immediately racing back to chapter 6 because you recall an eerily similar scene in the gospel. In chapter 6, verse 34, we read that he had compassion for them, namely a great crowd. But do you remember why it was that in chapter 6 that he had compassion on them? It was because they were as sheep without a shepherd. So he taught them, and then he fed them. And the feeding was astonishing. He took 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, and with that he fed over 5,000 people. And the people were full and satisfied. The disciples were amazed, and you, as you stood in the crowd watching this take place, you were amazed as well. And then we got to that astonishing point where the disciples were afraid for their lives on the water when Jesus came to them. And do you remember how Mark related this to us? For they did not understand about the loaves, he says, but their hearts were hardened. Aha. But now the disciples have another opportunity, another chance to show that their hearts are not hard. And we watch Jesus then perform an almost identical miracle. In fact, the only real noticeable difference between the first feeding and this feeding is that the narrative isn't as full with detail, and the numbers are smaller. He feeds fewer people, only 4,000. And this time, as the food goes around, there are 7 baskets full of bread left over. And then after he fed them, he sent them away, and he got into a boat. It all seems pretty basic, right? The same old thing going on. Jesus feeding a bunch of people. What's the big deal? We already saw this, Mark. You just told us this 2 chapters ago. But ask yourself the question, why did Mark put this particular story right here in the narrative, only 2 chapters after the last feeding? And why does Mark think it necessary to tell us 2 times that Jesus can feed a lot of people with a little amount of bread? Does that strike you as odd? If it does, then I would propose that you are beginning to think about Mark properly. The structure here is intentional, as it is always in the Gospel of Mark. The structure is intentional. And it is intentionally supposed to be getting you to start scratching your head a little bit. What are you doing here, Mark? Why are you telling me? Why are you bringing out these points, these facts, and putting them here in the narrative of Jesus, his life, and his ministry? Well, let's think about this a bit. Can you remember what the 2 big issues that were addressed, or encapsulated, if you will, between these 2 feeding narratives. The first was the purity controversy. You remember that one? Jesus, in effect, destroys the ritual purity boundaries, and in so doing prepares the people for a coming time when the temple will be replaced with the resurrected body of Jesus, and therefore all can be connected with God through union with Christ. And then second, we find this strange story about a Gentile woman from Syrophoenician origin. She comes up to Jesus and begs for Jesus to do what? To cleanse her daughter. Right after this whole issue of purity, we have a Gentile asking Jesus to cleanse her impure daughter. And then there is this strange conversation between the woman and Jesus about her ability to be at the table. And now with this picture in mind, let's take a look again at our new feeding story. What is the first question we should ask ourselves? Well, first we should ask ourselves, where are they? Location, location, location. Look at verse 31. They're right there in the region of the Decapolis. Now the Decapolis was a collection of about 10 Roman city-states. Directly east of the Galilee Sea, or Lake of Galilee. And they were used, these cities were used and placed on the edge of the Roman Empire to spread culture, Roman culture, to the far ends of the empire. So in asking the question another way, are they in Jewish or Gentile territory? Well, they're in Gentile territory. Now turn back with me for a moment to chapter 6, the first feeding. Where is Jesus when he feeds them? Look at verse 1. He starts there in his hometown. Starts in his hometown of Nazareth. And then he goes to the villages around Nazareth. He sends the disciples out to those villages, and then they collect, and this controversy comes around. So they're in the region of Nazareth, around Nazareth, where Jesus' hometown is. So asking the question in another way, are they in Jewish or are they in Gentile territory? Well, they're in Jewish territory in the first feeding. Let's take a step back for a moment and ask what is being assumed in the discussion between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. If we look at verse 26, Let's recall the conversation that went on. It says, she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And then he said to her, for saying that, you may go. What is the assumption? The underlying assumption that provides the basis or the foundation for this conversation to even take place. Well, the assumption is that if the food goes to the dogs, if the food is given to the dogs, the children will by consequence be deprived of food. So there's, you see, this dark black line that has been drawn between Jews and Gentiles. And it is assumed that there is only enough food for one group. You see, this was the assumption of the day. And I would argue that what is happening here is Jesus is toying with this assumption. And knowing that the people had this assumption, Mark placed this conversation at this point in the narrative to begin to erase and deconstruct that line. In other words, Jesus presents to the woman the Jewish understanding of the relationship between Jews and Gentiles, namely, that if food is taken away from, or if food is given to the Gentiles, or blessing given to the Gentiles, then it will by consequence be taken away from the Jews. And then he lets her break down that assumption. And what you may notice is that she is the first and the only person in the Gospel of Mark to address Jesus as Lord. Kurios, Lord. You see, this dark black line that has been drawn with the implicit assumption that if you feed the Gentiles, the Jews will be deprived, is intentionally set up by Jesus and then erased by a Gentile. And of all people, a Gentile woman with an impure daughter. See, now we find ourselves in Gentile territory here in Mark chapter 8. In what Mark calls the wilderness, the Gentile wilderness. And we see Jesus feeding a large group of people. And the result is 7 baskets full of leftover bread. There is no shortage. There is no deprivation of the Jews because the Gentiles are fed. The response of the Gentile woman is lived out, and it's proven by Jesus. Why? Because he had compassion on the crowd, for they had been with him for 3 days. And what is amazing about this is that we see the extent and the abundance of Jesus' mercy. And the bread here really does fill 2 images, one of physical care and one of spiritual care. You see, as a real person, flesh and bones, Jesus cared for the physical bodies of the crowd. He cared for their well-being. And yet, how often do we fret and worry that he won't take care of us? That we've been with him for a long time, and now it's been a while, so we need to pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps. It's time we work things out on our own, we think. How often do we simply fail to approach Jesus in prayer and ask for his abundant grace? Simply ask for him to take care of us as he does. Frequently, you see, his blessings don't come in the way we expect him. We're like the disciples. But Jesus, there's not enough bread in the supermarket to feed all these people. If I went all the way down to the Oro Wheat bread outlet, I couldn't get enough to feed these people. It's not going to work. I don't know how we're going to do it. We can't do this. And yet, he has a way of surprising us, giving us a blessing in the way that we would never expect. And perhaps giving us a blessing that we would never realize we need until we have it. Friends, you have a compassionate and a merciful God who loves you abundantly. Don't ever forget that. Don't forget it in the midst of blessing and in the midst of trial. Don't forget who God is. Well, after the feeding, Jesus gets in the boat again and goes to the district of Dalmanutha, an area on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, and once again, we're in Jewish territory. And guess who decides to join the party? The Pharisees. Now, by this point in the story, we all know what's going down when the Pharisees come to town, right? We all see it coming. And when the Pharisees drive up, what are you thinking? Oh boy, here they come again. Trouble is brewing. And they walk straight up to Jesus and immediately begin to argue with him. The end result, they say, is, "Jesus, show us a sign from heaven. Prove to us that you are God, Messiah, Savior, because we don't believe you." And Mark says they did this to test him. And Jesus responds by letting out a deep sigh. Perhaps a sigh of disbelief, or maybe frustration. Personally, I think it was a sigh of sadness. And he says, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation." And then, literally, as the text translates, he dismissed them. Getting in the boat again, he went across to the other side. But while in the boat, Jesus, as usual, took this time to teach his disciples. You see, the problem was the disciples forgot to bring food with them. Interesting, isn't it? We just saw the crowds two times who didn't have food with them, and Jesus takes care of them. And the disciples don't believe Jesus. They don't know how it's going to happen, but he does it. And now it's the disciples who do not have bread with them. So because of their forgetfulness, they had only one loaf among all of them. And using this loaf as a symbol, Jesus tells them, "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod." And the disciples say, "It is because we have no bread that he said this." What? Think about that response for just a minute. Jesus says, "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod," or in other words, "Beware of the ingredients that the Pharisees and Herod are putting into the mixer." Oh, Jesus, you're saying this because we forgot our bread on the shore, right? And Jesus is shocked. "Why are you still talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand?" And then notice what Jesus says. "Are your hearts hardened?" After giving example after example of Jesus providing the bread needed for everyone, there was always someone there with a hard heart. First, during the first feeding episode, it was the disciples. They didn't believe because we are told that they did have a hard heart. And now it's a question posed to them. Are your hearts hard? At first, the declaration of the disciples' hard heart was a question that was posed to you as a reader who sat beside the disciples on the boat in chapter 6. Are you like the disciples? Is your heart hardened also? But now, after seeing Jesus destroy ritual purity boundaries and provide enough bread for Jew and Gentile alike, the question is thrust straight at you. Do you believe? Or are you still talking about having no bread because your heart is hardened? This whole narrative has been about hard hearts and fulfilled requests for bread. And yet here we find a shift to the reason for the hard heart. Do you remember the challenge that came to Jesus just before he got in the boat? The Pharisees came and they asked him for a sign to test him. And now here, on the heels of the question, "Is your heart hard?" Jesus asked a few more other questions. And I want to pay attention to those a little bit. First, do you have eyes and fail to see? And second, do you have ears and fail to hear? Think about that question for just a moment. What image is painted on your mind? How can you have eyes and fail to see? How in the world can you have ears and fail to hear? You see, with this question, Mark is bringing us right back to verse 11 and the Pharisees. Time and again, Jesus had demonstrated his power and his faithfulness. Yet again, they came and asked for a sign to test him. In essence, Jesus is asking if the disciples are doing the exact same thing. Why are you still concerned with bread? Why are you following me? Do you have eyes but cannot see? Are they just testing? and just lukewarm, following around Jesus with no sense of commitment. So as soon as trouble comes, as soon as we see John the Baptist on a head, his head on a platter presented to Herod and Herodias, we scatter and flee into the winds. But now let's look a bit deeper. You see, Mark is constantly placing you as a reader beside the disciples. And so in a sense, this question is to you as well. Is your heart hard? Are you committed to Jesus, truly committed? Or will the smallest of adversities or annoyances in the church cause you to give up? Do you have eyes but cannot see, and ears but cannot hear? See, in our modern culture, in America today, a common response to Christianity is, I can't believe because I don't have a sign. You see, in the Old Testament, you had seas being split open. You had water coming out of rocks. You had the day standing still. In the New Testament, you have bread coming out of nowhere. You have Jesus walking on water. Why doesn't God do that today? If he just did that today, then I would believe. Or if God just opened up the clouds and peeled them back and said, hey, fellas, I'm still here, believe, then I would believe. Heard that countless times. You see, the problem with this approach is that God has already done that. He has come to this earth as a man. He has died and he rose from the grave. But what do we do with it? With eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear, we explain it away. We always will explain it away. Because we don't really want it, do we? Why not? Because we know that if we do find it, if we stop testing and start truly seeking him, seeking Jesus for life and for commitment, our whole lives will be changed. They'll be shaken up forever. I'm always reminded of a quote C.S. Lewis provides in his book, Miracles. He says, "It is always shocking to meet life where we thought we were alone. Look out, we cry, it's alive. And therefore, this is the very point at which so many draw back. I would have done so myself if I could, and proceed no further with Christianity. An impersonal God? Well and good. A subjective God of beauty, truth, and goodness, inside our own heads? Better still. A formless life force surging through us, a vast power which we can tap. Best of all, but God himself. Alive, pulling at the other end of the cord, perhaps approaching at an infinite speed, the hunter, king, husband. That is quite another matter. There comes a moment when the children who have been playing at burglars hush suddenly. Was that a real footstep in the hall? There comes a moment when people who have been dabbling in religion suddenly draw back, supposing we had really found him. We never meant for it to come to that. Worse still, supposing he had found us. You see, when our eyes cannot see and our ears cannot hear, so frequently we walk around a room pretending that we're searching, or truly searching. Pretend that we are in this search with all of our heart, but we are simply stumbling in the dark, explaining away anything and everything that we stumble into. What we realize is that when Jesus finds us, he opens our eyes, and there is no turning back at that point. Jesus and the disciples come then to Bethsaida, and a blind man is brought to Jesus. And out of compassion and mercy, Jesus takes the man. He puts saliva on his eyes, and he touched him. And then the man responds, I see people, but they look like trees walking around. And then Jesus touched his eyes again, and his sight was restored so that he could see all things clearly. And then he is sent away, but told not to enter the village. Have you ever wondered why that is? Why does every time Jesus heals somebody or casts demons out, Jesus says, don't tell them who I am? Or he commands the demons, tell nobody that I am the Son of God. His identity is concealed throughout the Gospel of Mark thus far, and he wants to ensure that it is concealed. Why does Jesus always tell people to be silent about his identity? Well, you'll have to come back next week for the answer to that question. This little healing episode here is a vital part of Mark's gospel because it stands at a critical junction in the narrative. And it is, in my estimation, vital for preparing both the disciples and you as a reader to move on. You see, when we move into chapter 8, a whole new journey will develop. There will no longer be boating trips to the Gentiles, because Jesus will begin his final trip to Jerusalem, the site of the temple, the site of the Jewish religious leaders, where the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees resides. But first, before Jesus took this final journey, the disciples needed to ask the question, and they needed to answer the question, are your hearts hard? Do you have eyes but cannot see? For you must see Jesus' miracles and works in light of his final work on the cross, accepting the punishment of Rome and of God. It appears that there is some heavy symbolic value to this event as well. You see, just as the man at first did not understand the difference between trees and men, so too the disciples will not initially understand why Jesus has to die. And as the warnings are given, they'll say, no, this can't be right, Jesus. But the warning is here given. Don't lose heart. You will see it soon, clearly enough. And yet, how true is that in our lives as well? We want everything right now. We want to know it all. We want to understand it all. And as we grow older, we realize how little we truly knew before. But just like the blind man in Bethsaida, Mark is calling us to a life of faith in the midst of things that we don't quite understand at the moment. Be it those of you in the faith, and the many ways that the Lord is working in your life, which you don't quite understand, and perhaps you're frustrated with him in the moment. He's calling you to a life of faith. He will open your eyes clearly one day. Or those of you who don't believe, who are skeptical and won't believe until you have all the answers, to you, Mark is saying, you'll never have all the answers because none of us have all of the answers or ever will. But he is calling you to a life of faith, and Jesus will open your eyes to see clearly, and you will be changed when you find him. And so I want to bring us back to our question of signs, but I want to ask a new question. Why are we always looking for signs from God? Well, you say, because we want to see him if he exists. We want to see these signs if he really exists. Because we want to be certain that he is there before we believe. Really? Is that really why? Let me offer a proposition. Just think about it. Chew on it for a while. We mentioned before that signs carry with them a certain vagueness, whether it be a stop sign in a child's bedroom, or a stop sign on the road at an intersection, or a stop sign in an old, run-down, abandoned warehouse. Signs carry a certain vagueness because signs are always contextual. They operate in a context. And what if? What if the reason we are always searching for signs is because signs will always give us a way out? Because we can always manipulate the context. And so I'm going to ask you to perhaps think about it in another way. Why are you searching? What are you searching for? You see, when you go to a foreign country and read the laws of the road, you seek those laws out because though you don't know them, you know that they must be there in order to uphold order in that country. So what are you searching for? Perhaps you know something must be there, but you don't quite want to find him or be accountable to him. You see, friend, this is the beauty of the gospel. When you find him in faith, he doesn't punish you. He pardons you. And he gives you righteousness because he became a man and suffered on your behalf. And so we finish off by asking the question, what's the big deal with the bread? Why is it so important in this passage? Well, you may find it interesting to note that in this brief section, these two chapters from the first feeding to the second, the word bread is used 16 times. After this section, in the remainder of the gospel, it's used only once, when Jesus himself calls himself the bread of life in chapter 14. At this point in the story, you, as a reader, are being called to consider your understanding of the bread. You expect to be nourished by it. You expect to have a positive experience. And yet, what do we do with all of these negative and embarrassing experiences that we've seen so far? The disciples didn't get it. The Pharisees and Herod are associated with leaven in the bread. And what does bread have to do with a man walking on the sea? As readers, we come and desire a positive and satisfying literary experience, especially with the association of bread. But this desire is constantly being shoved into the closet with these difficult elements. The enemies of Jesus are mounting, and now we are placed in a position where we are anxious for the resolution. And the resolution only comes when we realize that Jesus is the true and greater bread. He sustains us both physically and spiritually, and he calls us to follow him even when we don't understand all of life, to place our faith in him and to be united and committed to him, the bread of life. Let us pray.